said you can kill my body, but you know you can't mess with my mind.
Welcome to Economics and Beyond. I'm Rob Johnson, president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking.
Say you can kill my body.
Say you can kill my body.
But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Say, no, you can't kill my mind.
You know we'll go away.
We're gonna go away.
Come back, come back, come back,
come back.
My second time.
I'm here today with Abigail Disney. She's the founder and CEO of Forked Films. She's the founder of Peace So Loud, an activist organization. And most recently, she's founded a podcast called All Ears with Abigail Disney. She's an Emmy-winning director of the film Armor of Light. And she was also a producer and worked closely with the director on a film which I watched recently called Pray the Devil Back to Hell, which is about a terrible period in the history of Liberia and the role that women played in putting things back together. Abigail, thanks for joining me today.
So happy to be here.
This is an extraordinary time. We're speaking in late 2020 on the cusp of a presidential election in the United States when the whole world has been awakened and the failings in the structure of our society, many of which you have illuminated in your all forms of your work, are being what you might call thrust onto the surface. What are you seeing right now that you like? What are you seeing that you wish was what are you not seeing that you wish was happening? What are you seeing that you dislike? And let's explore how this unmasking is affecting your perceptions of what to do and the kind of work you want to do.
Well, you know, I've spent, you know, almost all of my adult life thinking about, talking about, trying to address inequality in various ways and various forms. And so when you do that, as you have also done yourself, you get a little frustrated with the way it's not there. There's a way you can live in America of not knowing. You know, everything about the media environment, the social environment, aids and abets you in not knowing things that you really should know. And so we got away with a lot in this march toward grave inequality that we have gone through in the last few decades, because people just either won't look or can't look, or, you know, or just refuse to know. And when the pandemic hit, it struck me that it was the first time in my life and probably ever that everyone on Earth was scared in the same way about the same thing, which is kind of actually interesting. But we also all saw, no one can deny that they saw, that inequality laid so bare, because it wasn't just a difference between people who had better cars or people who had, you know, bigger houses. This was a difference between people who could not choose not to take a risk of their own lives to go to work to get enough money to feed themselves, as opposed to all of the rest of us. When that started to happen, and we started to see human beings having to take fatal risks just to get through their everyday because of the nature of the economic situation they were in, none of us could pretend anymore that this system was working well. And that was thrilling for me, because, like, at least now we can assume we're all starting from the same base of information and we can work from there. So, and the people who want to defend this system are going to have to defend it in the face of what they've seen.
You did a TED Talk recently, and you described in the context of your family's history the role of Jiminy Cricket as your favorite character. What did Jiminy Cricket bring to your spirit?
Well, you know, it was a slow dawning for me, because my kids really liked that film when they were little. So I watched it through a bunch of times, and I kept trying to figure out for myself, what was it exactly that I was seeing or hearing in Jiminy Cricket that was so familiar. And then when he said "Golly Gee Willikers" one more time, I realized that was what I always loved about the way my grandfather expressed himself. He was a humble Midwestern guy. His name was Roy. He was Walt's brother, and they came together and started the company together from Kansas. And my grandfather never, ever, ever changed once from what he was like when he was a bank teller in Kansas. He just was a humble guy who had this really sweet way of expressing himself, and Jiminy just sounded like him. And then I started to think about it more, about the dynamics between Roy and his brother, Walt. And they really were exactly reflective of the dynamics between Walt and Roy. You know, Walt will go off and spend all the money or get a big idea or whatever, and Roy would come along after him and find the money and put the structure around it. And so they were it and super ego together. But the other thing that Jiminy does, and the reason I used him, you know, as a way to talk about contemporary business culture, is he always says the thing that ruins all your fun, the thing that gets in the way of your momentum, but the thing that you really have to attend to, which is, well, what about, you know, what are you really going to leave your Geppetto and not come back and become an actor? And all, you know, basically the ethics. He always comes to you with the ethical concern, which is why his first and most famous line is about conscience. Always let your conscience be your guide. So that actually struck me as the perfect metaphor for what has been sort of ushered from the room over the last 50 years in the American business culture, and a perfect metaphor for what needs to be brought back in. Somebody who will ask very hard questions, but very basic ones. Somebody who will attend to, as though it matters, the ethical concern. I knew my grandfather well. I was 12 when he died. So yes, I was young. And so I probably was still a little overly stars in my eyes about who he was. And he wasn't perfect. But I do remember the way he treated people when he went to the park, when he brought me there. And I do remember the way he talked to me about that. And one of the things he said was, these people work very hard, and so much harder than you can imagine. And if you don't respect them, I am going to be, you know, he would really threaten all kinds of things. So this was really important to him. This was a high priority, that work equals our respect. And when I think about the contrast between that attitude and what's happening now today, when I go and talk to the people who work in the park now, I want to cry. Because of my grandfather, I developed this real affection for the kind of people who come to work at Disney, who are not just burger flipping whatever. They love their work. They work at Disney because they feel like they're doing something good for the world. And they really are. When families come to that place, they are having important moments that they will share forever, that this is a good thing. And they are not interchangeable cogs in a machine. They are not just, you know, if you don't like the job, just go work somewhere else kind of people. And that they are being treated with the kind, I mean, and I consider it to be a form of disrespect to be paid unfairly, to be worked too hard without recognition, to be asked to produce more and more and more in less and less time, and then to be stripped of things like healthcare, like paid time off, like a pension, and everything else that's been stripped of the American worker. Well, as we've all been looking on, you know, they can't drive their cars to work without breaking an axle half the time because the infrastructure died. They can't send their kids to college anymore because it's gotten out of reach. There are so many things that have happened to this American worker in the last 50 years. It's been a one-way ticket to something that I know for a fact when I was growing up was not the deal that we had all signed up for as a society. So I use Jiminy Cricket as a way of sort of reminding us all that this still small voice inside of you, as he calls your conscience, isn't just a nuisance. It is actually not proper to try to conduct yourself without checking in with it very often.
Well, you talk about in your TED Talk about mindset, about in essence, There are stories, we'll call them, of economic theory, shareholder value. Michael Jensen, Milton Friedman set it off, and Michael Jensen was the evangelist, if you will, at the Harvard Business School. Mm-hmm. And we look at these things, and now we have people like Jamie Dimon, Business Roundtable, Chamber of Commerce, and others talking about stakeholder value. But then there are people like Joel Bacon, who I just made a podcast with, who are saying, is that a false consciousness or is that good guy marketing? And I'm reluctant when people of power say shareholder value is not legitimate anymore. I think they are making a contribution. But I'm also, I wear the caution light that Joel Bacon asserts, which is, if they're just trying to be friendly in order to sell you more popsicles or movies or whatever it is, but they're not practicing what they preach, then you go back to someone like Reinhold Niebuhr, Moral Man and Moral Society. You got to do things that force people to practice what they preach. You can't count on them to resist the siren song of temptation.
Right, exactly. So a lot has shifted in terms of the law, of the way we function. You know, taxes have been dropped, regulations have been stripped, unions have been kneecapped. There's no antitrust enforcement. So a lot of things in the concrete world of things we can touch have changed in the last 50 years, and they have in large measure driven this inequality rise. But my grandfather would never have taken $66 million for a benefit for 1 year of work. Never would have even occurred to him. And not necessarily because it wasn't legal. It would have been legal for him to do it, I suppose, if he'd wanted. But because it wasn't done. It just wasn't done. And nobody would even, it wouldn't cross anybody's mind to do it. That's a mindset shift. And that is probably more of a driver of the problems that we have than any single law or regulation or act of government. And that's what I'm talking about. And shareholder primacy was embraced and being taught in business schools at the exact moment when every CEO that we currently talk about were in business school or you know, cutting their teeth at their first job as an executive. So what we have is a whole generation of leaders who are running companies who treat shareholder primacy as not just the thing people value, but as a moral truth. Because, you know, don't forget, Milton Friedman said, you will achieve the best and highest result for everyone if you're greedy, or if you pursue your own self-interest, or if you pursue the interests of the corporation you run as well as you possibly can. He was offering moral cover to people who needed not to feel like bad guys, as they'd been made to feel in the 1960s, for pursuing profit. He said, no, profit good, profit not bad. So when he offered moral cover, I really do think that the C-suite class took that in and ran with it. And there is a sanctimony in the way you get pushback from old school CEOs about the shareholder value story. And you can hear it there. It's like a religious belief in them. So when the Business Roundtable, you know, which was one of the prime drivers of this mindset shift long ago, says stakeholder capitalism, goodness, I'm thrilled to pieces, because it's nice to hear that kind of language coming from, in particular, that place. I would love to hear it from the Chamber of Commerce even more. But that is a harder thing to execute on than it is to simply say. So I don't know how much of this is marketing, but I do know I haven't seen a lot of material change. When Jamie Dimon speaks well of shareholder or stakeholder capitalism, he's still head of a vast financial organization that has not just contributed to, but in many ways shaped and benefited from, certainly, and continues to benefit from, the financialization of the economy, which has driven a lot of the inequality that we're looking at today. Like, so unless he's willing to address the way in which, I mean, it's like Anna Wintour saying that we really have a problem with bulimia and anorexia. You know, you can't take on the problem if you're the one who's driving it, unless you really look at the structure of what you're inside of. When Jamie Dimon wants to go back and sit with Katie Porter in the Congress and have a real exchange about why that single mother who's working as a bank teller cannot put money together enough to just support herself and her daughter, rather than to be defensive about it and then to just retreat behind, well, I don't know, I'll have to get back to you on that. He was faced in that moment with this absolute that presented him with the idea that there was zero way for a person to live on what he was paying at the lowest levels. And he just retreated from that and never said anything about it again. So stakeholder capitalism is nice, but it's not specific enough about the idea that across the board in corporate America, we've accepted as perfectly okay that the lowest wage you can get away with legally is what you'll pay to a certain class of people who work for you. And if they can't live on it, that has nothing to do with you. I actually think that CEOs and the whole C-suite class need to understand that they work at the same company that the janitor works at. I mean, honestly, that's why a lot of the outsourcing has happened, because morally it can't be abided that you're actually the one exploiting this janitor. But let's be real. If they're cleaning the toilets in your building, then they are working for you and they are people who are in your orbit and you have a moral obligation to them. You have a moral obligation to every human being who works for you and supports profitability at your company. And before you're handing out the dividends, before you're investing in buybacks, before you're taking away eight-figure, nine-figure salaries, you got to make sure that all those people you have a moral obligation to, you're not harming. Like, first, don't harm them. And then why not make sure they're thriving? I mean, why on earth not? If Disney was pulling, I think it was $1.5 billion of profit, pure profit out of Disneyland in Anaheim in 2019. And from 2014 through 2019, they made something like $60 billion in share buybacks. I'm sure I got that number wrong. I apologize. But anyway, you get the idea. And at no time did they not continue to put pressure, downward pressure on salaries, upward pressure on productivity. So as the company became more profitable, no one who was engaged in creating those profits, or at least no one below a certain level, saw any of the benefit of doing that. And what I try to understand is, why wouldn't they? I don't understand why they don't get to participate as full human beings with equal rights and dignity in the very company they're working at.
When I was young, growing up in Detroit, one of the men that taught me baseball was named Dwayne Peterson. His son Steve was one of my friends out in the neighborhood. And Dwayne was part of the Whiz Kids, the group that worked at Ford Motor Company for Robert McNamara. And Mr. Peterson once told me a story which has stayed in my mind and comes back to me now, about Robert McNamara was asked at the Economic Club of Detroit. I haven't been able to trace this down, but I heard this story from him. He was asked, why do you make 14 times what the average worker makes? And his reply, which was to put people maybe a little off balance, anything more would be immoral. When I fast forward to the era of Newt Gingrich, I've been in the hedge fund industry working with George Soros, and I'm sitting around the community pool in Greenwich, Connecticut. Mm-hmm. I'm listening to the dialogue, people at lunchtime, and some of them are essentially saying, if you don't go out and get 300 to 500 times whatever the average worker makes, then you're a chicken. It's almost like there's this what would you call it? Narcissism, malignant self-love is the name of the book, about more and more and more money beyond having any real utility for life. It's almost an addiction.
Yes, it is an addiction. Yeah, actually, you just nailed it. It is an addiction. If you look at the dynamics of addiction, literally, what happens is, you know, you have your first drink, it's kind of yummy, it gives you a warm fuzz, so you have another drink because that's good. And you keep having that other drink because now you're getting a stimulus response kind of association in your head. But the fuzziness wears off a little, so you have two drinks. So you do that for a while, and then you have three drinks. And that is the dynamics of addiction, right? Because at some point now, you're chasing the warm fuzzy that you know you felt at one point. But, you know, pass a bottle of wine or a fifth of vodka or whatever your thing is, that never happens again. But you don't know how to stop chasing it. Now you've replaced the chase with the pleasure that you're seeking, and there is no pleasure in that chase. That is exactly how money works. Why on earth does Jeff Bezos need over $100 billion? Why does anyone need $1 billion if you can't get by on $999 million? I really don't understand what's going on with you. So the in a highly materialist society, one comes to mistake material things for things of value, and we are now measuring our worth, or many people are, especially in the places that you name, we're mistaking our wealth for our worth as human beings. And you can see them doing it. You can see them eyeing each other's cars. You can see them, you know, checking out the whether or not the pair of jeans they're wearing are truly jeans, or did they cost $500? This is a constant thing. And it leads to a sort of, as it does with alcohol, it leads to a sort of emptying out of the rest of you, because in the search, in putting the search ahead of everything else kind of atrophies. And so that's why I can't be in these spaces like private airplanes and private rooms and private schools and all the private, because you now are living just in a bubble where no one has questioned those values, so you're being reinforced in them every step of the way, and you're never forced to come face to face, as the pandemic brought us, with the reality of what your chase means to the rest of the world, to your fellow human beings. Because there is a relationship between how much money Jeff Bezos has and how little money everybody else does. It's not like a zero-sum game, and he's taking $160 billion from the mouths of poor people. But in a sense, he kind of is, because if he would choose to make less money in the process of doing that, I mean, that can be done. It can happen. It's actually not a crazy thing. And in the process, he simply paid people a dignified wage and just simply settled for less billions, then we'd have an entirely different set of circumstances to work with. So it is an addiction, and I've seen what it has done to people's spirits, and it has replaced God. If you listen to Milton Friedman, if you listen to Milton Friedman and you really drill down into the way he writes as a person and the way he spoke as a person, you actually start to hear something like a religious tone in his language. He is a little bit of a preacher, but of course he's a preacher for something deeply secular, and prided himself. I think he was an atheist. I'm pretty sure. I know Ayn Rand was. There was, in fact, in those circles, a contempt for faith as something sort of ridiculous and for, you know, suckers and chumps. And if that is the way, you know, there's nothing wrong with being an atheist. But if what you replace your spiritual life with is fully and totally material, then you can't help but get confused about what your priorities are going to need to be as a result of that.
It's not unlike what I'll call what psychologists call codependency.
Yes.
What Milton Friedman sounds like he's doing is he's providing an anesthetic when you're wrestling with dilemmas to allow you to become more codependent on the satisfaction of money. But as psychologists talk about in the context of relationships, codependency is not love. It's an illness.
Well, and many times it's the opposite of love.
Exactly. And it leads you off the rails in what you pursue, and what you might call at the end of the day, there's no pot of gold at the end of that rainbow.
Right.
And so I think the problem is, as we get this, what I'll call amplifying feedback loop, as power gets concentrated and the powerful have this codependent addiction to money,
yes,
what does it take to break us out of it? And I guess coming back to my original question, if there's a higher power, did she drop this pandemic on us to get us to right our ship and get back to what matters?
I doubt that, because of the real suffering that it's created.
Yeah.
We don't deserve it. But I will say, it may be, if there's a higher power, she dropped Donald Trump on us, because Donald Trump is really, I almost see this pandemic as a symptom of a bigger problem. And Donald Trump is a symptom of a bigger problem, which is sort of replacing material things for worth and value and moral standing and so forth. So he is a person who purely measures a person's value on what he can bring. It's totally transactional guy. The narcissism of sort of in the kind of monstrous quality of the ever self-seeking, my own self-interest in everything. He is the result of 40 years of greed is good, not just economics and not just business, but greed is good as it burbled into our social understanding of human relationships. He is the ultimate individual in a society that only values individualism. And so, of course, the place total individualism has to lead you is to narcissism. And if what you have is a society of 330 million narcissists, it would look a lot like the society we're living in right now. It's not a functioning, it's sustainable way to live. So there was never anything wrong with proposing that shareholders mattered. There was never anything wrong with saying, let's not lose track of the point that the shareholders hire and fire me as CEO, and so I should be paying attention to their worth. Shareholders are perfectly morally neutral people. Many of them are retirees, you know, relying on the growth of the stock market to fund their retirement. So I don't begrudge shareholders making money. That's why I was able to make films. That's, you know, I'm a shareholder myself. None of that is the problem. The problem is the way that we've lost our sense of balance. I am saying that what we need is to restore some sense of balance, to bring the thing that's been driven out of the room back into the room, and not let it replace what's in the room, but let it live in optimal tension with what's there. With unions were very empowered in the 1950s and early 1960s. The part of the campaign of the last 50 years on the part of conservatives has been to disempower them, and they've been wildly successful. Well, now we have a problem, right? And this is going to be a problem for businesses, because now we have unions so totally disempowered that they are unable to negotiate really anything. And so workers are suffering and the middle class has hollowed out. And who's going to be able to afford a ticket to Disneyland? I mean, really, that's kind of the end game of where we are. So ultimately, for long term, for corporations, this is not a good system. And we need to take responsibility for what is happening here. So the answer to that is not to bring a union back and make it be in charge of every decision that Disney makes. What we do need is for unions to return to a state of optimal tension, where you lose 50% of your battles and you win 50% of your battles. That's what we need to see. We need to see a battle happening in boardrooms between people who represent the interests of the shareholders and people who say, but wait, I know our shareholders benefit by, say, a multi-decade campaign trying to persuade people there's no such thing as global warming, but I think that's probably not morally acceptable. That guy got chased out of the boardroom, and there is no optimal tension between those two arguments. And that's what I'm saying, is an overemphasis on what's material and an underemphasis on what's, you can call it spiritual, emotional, abstract, whatever you want to call it, has driven us to a place where this business world has become so rapacious and so empowered, and the people in it have become so rapacious and empowered that they are willing to look the other way for what are active and visible injustices being done every day to their fellow Americans.
In this context, like you say, shareholders are important, But it's a question of balance, to use the name of a Moody Blues album. And you're looking at this getting out of line and then becoming more and more extreme. And I want to go back to a notion that you said in the very beginning, that in America we can be, what you might call, propelled along a trajectory of not knowing. We're feeling, but not knowing. And there is a media, which is a private sector entity, which, how would I say it, has to pay the bills, has to do its own version of shareholder maximization. And what they choose to promote or illuminate and what they choose to neglect. Sometimes what you might call people are deferential to power by choosing silence rather than exploring the contradictions. So I'll quote from the Moody Blues. Why do we never get an answer when we're knocking at the door with 1,000,000,000 questions about hate and death and war? Because when we stop and look around us, there's nothing that we need in a world of persecution that's burning in its greed. Mm. Let me ask you, we've got this dreadful world. I've just said sometimes the media doesn't, what you might call, challenge the not knowing. But many times that's, I've seen the role of the arts, the poet, the filmmaker, the musician has been catalytic to the awakening. And this is a very large part of your life. You've made films about Liberia. You've made films about the death of a young man and an evangelist. And how do you see the ways to what you might call cure the not knowing?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, and the not knowing, there's a word, and I'm not sure what it is. I think it's anagnosia, which refers to the act of not knowing, the act of unknowing. It's a verb, because, you know, to not know these things is an effort you have to make, and which is why the private rooms, the private planes, et cetera, et cetera. That is part of the anagnosia of the privileged class, because it makes it easier to accommodate yourself. I did not make my first film until I was 46. You know, I'd been living life as an activist. I found myself in Liberia for complicated reasons, and I overheard this story, and I came home thinking, well, why did this story never get told? I know there are more stories than we can possibly hear out there in the world, but I also know from my work with grassroots women, especially, what stories mean to them when they hear them. And this story would be really important. So I kind of came home angry that I didn't already know the story, because it seemed to me the storytellers I trust at the New York Times and other places had failed in something really important. So what I wanted to do was to tell people facts and information. That was how I came to making a film, is the best way to make sure people knew the story. And I was very lucky to partner with an incredibly talented director, Ginny Rediker, in making that film, because she was so good at restraining my impulse as an activist to essentially grab the audience by the lapels and pull them really close to my face and say, you need to know these things, because that is very often how we try to get people to know things that they're choosing not to know, right? It's frustrating, it's angry making, and you want to tell them and you want them to hear it and you want to see them cry once they really understand it. But of course, that's not the way art works. And when art is good, art uses other ways to the heart. In fact, in many ways, facts and information are disruptors of that process. And I kept thinking of it as like a ride. You're on a ride. And every time we would give you a piece of information or a number or something, you would kind of come up from this state of quasi-consciousness that we had conjured in the film, and that would break a spell. And you'd have to get the spell to work again to bring them back with you. The valuable thing that happens in film, especially, but in all of the arts, is a kind of otherworldly engagement between the art and the viewer, or the art and the audience, or whatever it is, a reader and a good book, where you kind of go into a state of communion with the art, and you're occupying a space together so completely that you don't even really remember what you had for breakfast or that your knee hurt when you walked into the theater or whatever. I mean, people are cracked wide open by a really good film, a really good TV show, a really good book. They open up, and then you have this chance to kind of have a dialogue with the deepest parts of them. And what mainstream Hollywood does with that magic that they conjure reliably with their incredibly talented people is mostly awful, mostly terrible. But it's also possible to open people up and then kind of have an engagement that takes them somewhere they didn't know they wanted to go and is entirely new to them and might be uncomfortable to them, but by which they're thoroughly transformed. And you know, the Liberia film is not an easy film to watch. It's not all happy, happy. We take you all the way there in terms of showing you just how bad that war was and just what a personal violation it was to every family and every person in that country. War is a personal thing. It's not a political thing. And then we show you the work that the women do and the courage that it takes so that when you get to that payoff, when you get to that happy ending, you really earned your way to it. And it is so much more satisfying because of the way you know all that was at stake and you want to be those women. You want to be like them. In 72 minutes, that film takes 72 minutes. I had things happen like in Congo, I had three young men come up to me and say, I really never thought women could do anything good. I'm really thinking differently now. for to be able to conjure that kind of change in 72 minutes is you for me, I hadn't made a film before. I was almost drunk with the possibility of what you can do with this, because the mindset is what is our big barrier here to changing the way businesses practices into a more humane activity. And so that's where you get change in mindset, is with narrative and taking that old narrative that people are working with and, you know, showing it to them in all of its nakedness and maybe not very prettiness, and then helping to replace it with a narrative that works better for them and for everyone else. And that is what needs to happen here. And so, yes, there are a lot of books out there that are very thoughtful, and there's a lot of statistics, and there are a lot of activists and study groups and so forth. But I really believe that what needs to happen is for an assault, an all-out assault on the narrative we're currently functioning with, and a reimagining of how to tell a better story of what America could be.
Well, I use Phil Collins' song, Against All Odds. I was tremendously impressed by the courage and the vitality of the people in Liberia, the women in Liberia, that you made the focus of your film. I find it very inspiring. I'll go to another verse of the song Question by the Moody Blues, where they say, why do we never get an answer when we're knocking at the door? Because the truth is hard to swallow, but that's what the war of love is for. I mentioned to you in our preparation, because we're talking about what you might call the emotional resonance of beliefs, mindsets, ideas, and how they can become toxic. And I mentioned to you Eugene McCarroher's book, The Enchantment of Mammon. And one of the basic premises of that book is, when people thought we went after the Protestant Reformation from the decline of religion to a secular scientific society, what McCarroher says is, no, that religious yearning, those emotional impulses, just transferred onto things like markets and money as the object of worship. And what I thought as I was listening to you about the words and the ideas and the visual images that are, and the sounds that are in music or books or film, are ways to penetrate through what you might call the momentum or the audacity, the intimidation associated with some of these, what you might call evangelical speeches about secular things that should be means, not ends. A corporation is a means. Mm-hmm. A market is a means. Yeah. It is not the goal.
Exactly. Exactly. And if you listen to the language of the people who rose up in prominence, especially once Ronald Reagan was elected to office, and that there became this almost kind of a worshipful environment for CEOs. And, you know, people, I mean, Gordon Gekko, I was in the theater when Wall Street showed in New York City in 1987. I was in the theater and I saw young men get out of their seats yelling and cheering for Gordon Gekko when he said, "Greed is good." That film reflected something that was happening already, and it was the first we saw it in all of its nakedness. So I believe the reason religion never goes away, even though we get more scientific, is that there is something you might call a spirit inside of every human being, and it has longings, and so those longings will find a place. They will grab onto whatever they will grab onto. And with Milton Friedman and the people who followed him, it was markets. Markets were going to answer every question. And I always remind people, there's nothing, you know, you want to say you're an atheist and there's no spirit and everything is concrete and explainable. And yet you always lean into that invisible hand. I mean, what's more magical thinking really than an invisible hand? So there is always a need to explain the things you can't in somewhat magical terms. And the market took on, I think, a magical power to.
Yeah. What Joe Stiglitz always says is the invisible hand is invisible because it's not there.
I think of it another way. I think that in what we know about, because, you know, no matter how an American business culture ran down this rabbit hole and then proceeded to suck everybody who was vulnerable to the ideology into the rabbit hole with them, because, and that is why the business culture became so unadulterated in its pursuit of profits, because it's like then the people in it began to self-select there. But there's always been a different invisible hand, the other invisible hand, which doesn't live according to those principles, which chooses a career in teaching or, a career as, a nurse, rather than the pursuit of wealth, because they know that there are higher principles to serve and that money isn't that important and they'll be fine. And that is that the fact that we have gotten politically and even spiritually to the point of holding those kinds of people in contempt because they did not make a lot of money with themselves and saying, as we strip them of every, right and privilege they ever had, hold them responsible for their own suffering. We have taken the people who do represent the other invisible hand, which are the people who value what's not rational, who value what's not concrete, who value what is spiritual, who value higher purposes, and we've held them in contempt. We've looked at them as suckers and losers, as Donald Trump might put it. People who were pursuing things that, if you live purely in a material place, have no value. That takes us back to this question of balance. And that's why the idea of another invisible hand is helpful, because, you know, they can be joined into a sort of yin-yang shape. And that is where maybe we will be optimally equipped to handle each other. We need to restore respect and value to the professions that do the work of caring and educating and all of these kinds of things. And if we value those things, we're going to have to put an economic value on them.
In talking about the arts and so forth, as I listened to you, it reminded me, you know, McCarraher's book is called The Enchantment of Mammon, where the mammon is this business marketplace you're talking about. And during that time, while he and I were recording, my 11-year-old daughter, who writes poems, sent me a poem. And she was not at my office with me when I was recording, so it was just a coincidence. And the poem was called A Book. And I read it to him in honor of his book, which is the most meaningful book I have read in the past year, I believe. At least it's to help me the most. But she rewrote this poem, and she sent it to me this morning, and I saw it as I was preparing to talk to you. And as you were talking about your film and about the different ways in which consciousness is challenged, I wanted to read this poem. It's called a book. A book is simply paper. A book is hard. A book wants to be written. A book is an idea waiting to be created. A book is a secret, a rumor. A book shows you something you can only imagine of. A book describes you. A book is a character. A book is more than you can touch. A book is the little voice inside your head. A book is what keeps you up at night. When a book opens, it shows you answers. A book is what you can't stop thinking about. A book takes a midnight stroll through your mind. A book is that one thing that holds you to the earth. A book is transparent. A book is scared when you are. A book is overwhelmed when you're sad. A book is like a mountain. But even when you're at the top, you remember you have to climb back down. A book dances through the air, spreading its words to everyone. A book sways like the trees. A book is like an untamable animal. A book is calm as the wind. A book is like when you try to grasp something, but it's not there. A book sleeps when you put it down. A book is a person, just like me or you. A book is the sun's ray or the moon's shadow. The book is the light. A book is the dark. A book is the oceans. A book can whisper in your ear that everything will be okay. A book feels you. A book can understand you as if someone you've known your whole life. A book relates to you. But a book is simply paper. So that notion of the commodity that's the book,
right,
and the notion of that spiritual transmission and connection and energy that's within its covers, is to me kind of illuminating.
Oh, it is.
And about this process of learning, understanding, and believing. That we sorely need to change what you might call are the grounded beliefs and mindsets of our time. They are failing. That's when we talk about the pandemic is unmasking. When we talk about the kind of things that you raise in your films, this is what you might call a mode of transformational contribution.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And you know, honestly, I don't go into making a film looking to alter people and shape them in a particular image that I approve of. What I think is I'd like to make films that open people up and then they decide where to go with that. Too many things in our culture are exclamation points. And what we need are question marks. The only thing that is going to change the nature of our political discourse and the nature of the way we're living in almost every sector at this point is if we will just humble ourselves the tiniest bit and listen to people and ask questions and listen more than we talk. It's the only way we're going to be able to go forward. And that what she says about the book is actually quite good. I really, really do like your daughter from hearing that, because the, you know, a film is even less than a book in terms of what it is physically. It's light and sound waves. It's photons and sound waves. That is all a film is, if you think about it, and that it can make such an enormous difference in a person's life. I mean, it can be a pivot point in a person's entire life, and very often is one film. And that is a power we need to take seriously. And we need to be responsible for what we do with that power, and truthful in recognizing the effects it has in the world.
Let's talk about right now. Presidential election, what's on the horizon? You've been talking about deep needs to change. But what's like you're in the huddle. I'm talking using a football analogy right now. You're in the huddle and you're calling the play. What do we got to do?
Yeah, you know, I said this before the last election too, and I thought Hillary was going to win like everybody else. That the election is just going to be a moment in time. We have a way bigger problem, and we're going to have to get to work on real, not reconciliation is the only word I can think of it. And I've been to lots of pre-conflict, mid-conflict, post-conflict countries for the films that I've done over the years. And reconciliation is this really interesting thing because everybody who comes in after a war is talking about reconciliation, and I have never been in a place where I've actually seen it accomplished. Not even really, there's not a lot of satisfaction around South Africa's truth and reconciliation process, even though that's one of the most respected ones examples, and it's the closest anyone's gotten. But what's involved in reconciliation is what's involved in a very, very, very good apology, which is a recognition of the harm done, a taking of responsibility, a willingness to sit with the anger or the sadness that you've created in whoever is the object of the harm, and then a willingness to go forward from there in a better way. That's all a good apology is, and that's what reconciliation is about. We have to say, those of us in the world of, I don't know, progressive lefty politics, have to recognize that we've had a part in this. We are not innocent of the place that we currently stand. We have mocked and we have ridiculed people across the country for their faith, and we have made fun of their accents. We've ridiculed their education levels. There is a media elite and a coastal elite, and they do look down on the people in the middle of the country who vote for Donald Trump. So that has to be accepted.
Yes, Michael Sandel at Harvard and I just recently did a podcast on his new book called The Tyranny of Merit, which goes into these alienating rituals where in essence, the people who climb the ladder of meritocracy are responding to their own fears of being left behind. But once they reach attachment to the elite, they enable, perhaps unconsciously, but they enable cruelty. And they don't push things forward. I remember feeling like I worked a lot in finance, and I used to work with the Senate Banking Committee. And I remembered feeling after the TARP bailout that something was going to be horribly wrong. Again, quoting Joel Stiglitz, the polluters were going to get paid. And we got to this place and the despondency that led to change of the control of the House to Republican, change to the Senate, and then the White House, that I felt in many ways that the Democratic Party establishment contributed to the spawning of the Tea Party and Occupy, and continued to, what you might call, persist. And this may not be about the moral heart deficiencies of Democrats. It may be about the constraints of a structural system of money politics. But whatever happened, I believe that period was a co-author of the rise of Donald Trump. It created the context in which he could be elected. And what concerns me now about the Democratic Party on the eve of this election is that they are saying, elect Biden and Harris because Trump is so much worse. Least worst is not what gets people out of bed. And as you talked about it, a reconciliation. Yes, things were not all wonderful in the Obama years. They may have been better in the Trump years from your mind, but they contributed to the rise. Right now, what have we learned? What is a Biden administration, which obviously as vice president is affiliated with the Obama administration, going to do differently to come to a place where when elected, we turn the corner and we don't go back to building the next Trump?
And actually, Naomi Klein's book, The Shock Doctrine, is a really good way of understanding how the Clinton administration and Democrats in general and the Democrat technocrats who have ruled around the world have really, in fact, contributed mightily to this idea that there's a coastal elite and that Democrats are, you know, all snobs and limousine liberals and the rest of it. It's true. You know, it's true. Who carries the water for the carried interest loophole but Chuck Schumer? So, you know, we need to recognize that what became known as the Washington Consensus around the world, that you need to free up the markets and then pay for education, because if people just get educated, then everything will be hunky-dory, is a complete non sequitur. The most irritating thing for me, as I've said things publicly about the Walt Disney Company, is that they apparently they send a targeted tweet to all my Twitter followers after I say anything about them. And it talks about their education program. And I love their education program. It's great. You know, that's wonderful. But one thing has nothing to do with the other. If I, you know, spent my entire day working my back into absolute agony by changing sheets on many beds and folding many towels and doing tons and tons of laundry, I don't get to get paid better later if I try. I should be paid for the work I did today. You don't get to promise me better at some other point if I show you that I will make the effort to get it. That is not how it works. The negotiation between an employer and employee is, I pay you for the work you do today. And if it was hard work, I pay you well. And I respect you for it, and I thank you for it, because I'm not willing to do it to myself. And so when we talk about this, like, I will help you get on the escalator, is a way of saying, I accept the fact that at the bottom of the escalator, there are a whole bunch of people living lives of quiet desperation. That is acceptable to me, what happens at the bottom of the escalator. And maybe lots of people never get on the escalator, and that's their own fault. There's only so much room at the top. You can't put everybody on the escalator. So if you were going to have this permanent class of people living at the bottom, then why is it all right that vast swaths of our fellow humans are not able to put food on the table without the indignity of having to go to a pantry, get a food stamp from the government, and so forth? I don't understand this. Because as I keep trying to say this in ways, in every kind of way that I can, and the rejection of the idea that people at the bottom deserve a living wage from those at the top who really almost religiously believe they don't, I think is like a form of prejudice. It's the same as racism. It's looking upon those people at the bottom as not really quite the same human as you are. Looking on them as less than. The book you need to read is Caste, Isabel Wilkerson's book, which kind of reframes racism in America as a caste system rather than this kind of hatred for one group of people just because of the color of their skin. It's really more like, I need you to live at the bottom and I need you to stay at the bottom. That's where you're appropriate. And it makes more sense of the fact that NBA stars are, you know, subjected to random arrests and beatings, even though they're multimillionaires. You can't rise up out of a caste. And I believe that we've also got a caste going of the people who live in the bottom at minimum wage, who have now had lives constructed around them, circumstances constructed around them that guarantee they will never not be working two or three jobs. They will never not be worried about paying down their mortgage or having too much credit card debt. They are living in a hole, and the ruling class is content to leave them in that hole.
And school systems,
yeah,
based on public school local budgets,
exactly,
and the attempts to reduce mobility through the confinement by not supporting transportation systems, puts these people in a place where their own children, yeah, will not have,
exactly,
what you might call the promise of the land of opportunity,
exactly,
to draw upon. I wanted to bring another religious track. There's a woman that I once heard speak at the Union Theological Seminary and on a panel with me named Catherine Tanner. I believe she's at University of Chicago now. And she wrote a book called The Economy of Grace. Mm. And in it, she said, there is a sense in which people used to say, how would I say, if they were fortunate in their life, that God had bestowed upon them something which, how would I say, gave them a responsibility to become a steward. Mm-hmm. And I'm using my own words, not hers literally. But in The Economy of Grace, she paints these scenarios where when people make a lot of money, they say, God has chosen me and not them. And they somehow feel a self-satisfied, what I'll call false spirituality, that their wealth is a signal that they are the chosen ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and absolutely.
And this,
that is what's being said nakedly in the evangelical circles that are supporting Donald Trump. That actually is a point, an article of faith in the evangelical movement they call, what is it called again? Prosperity Gospel. People like Paula White, who are advising President Trump and who represent, Joel Osteen is another one, people who represent huge numbers of evangelicals. It is central, critical to the way they understand how God works. That the people who have money because God gave it to them. You know, this actually, it's a hard thing if you were, I was raised as a Catholic. I don't know what your background is, but if you're raised as a Catholic.
Scottish Presbyterian mother.
okay. Protestantism rose up out of what Luther had to say, out of what Calvin had to say, and others. And what was central to the belief system, as opposed to what they had been taught as Catholics or pre-Protestants, was that God makes every decision before you're even born. It's all laid out. And everyone is morally depraved. The minute you're born into this earth, you're covered in sin. And so, first of all, you have to spend your whole life, you know, appealing to God and appealing to your belief to hold you apart from and protect you from sin. So, you know, if you believe that line of reasoning and you watch Fox News, you would precisely be a voter for Donald Trump. It would make perfect sense. And if God's made all the decisions, people have money because God gave it to them. And if you put your faith in God, he'll reward you. And that is why Paula White and Joel Osteen and others raise so much money. And that is why Donald Trump gets the respect that he does, because he's playing into this narrative of how his success, his alleged success, is a reflection of his value as a human being. It's an unfortunate thing that this theology has come together in a society that's highly individualistic and highly materialistic, because those three things come together into a horribly toxic brew. But that is a form of faith that has many, 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 many adherents, and it makes up the lion's share of the evangelicals that support Trump.
As we're coming down the stretch here, I want to talk with you a little bit about, you and I met when Winnie Bianima, Jeff Sachs, and I did a panel before the Patriotic Millionaires.
Yes.
And we had a nice conversation on the side that day with the help of our friend Erica Payne, connecting us, because she knows what you might call some of our similarities of background with film and the like. But Morris Pearl, the leader of that, he's just creating, I believe, a book that comes out here in the next couple of weeks called Tax the Rich.
Yes.
And I'm curious just about your impressions. Morris and his team are housed in my offices at the Institute for New Economic Thinking.
Great.
And I'm just curious, what do you see as the role of patriotic millionaires, and why do you think people should join?
I have seen it in my own advocacy that when I speak up for a position that is counterintuitive or unexpected, it gets, suddenly people are listening. If I were to talk about, you know, golf courses and how I don't want to pay a lot in taxes, nobody would be paying any attention to me right now. It's because of the fact that I, in this highly getting the most for yourself system, it's very counterintuitive that I'm saying what I'm saying. And it's amazing to me that people, there was once a Snopes article about how, yes, I had once said that the rich should pay more taxes because it was that hard to believe. And that depresses me deeply, because it seems like impossible to people, apparently, that you would have a higher wish than your own self-interest for the country you live in. But nevertheless, that's the way it's working. So the patriotic millionaires have been so great at giving me opportunities to speak up about these things. I don't think I would have been on CNBC a year and a half ago if it hadn't been for them. And then I went and said something viral and the rest is history. And I have really, they have helped me shape and refine a lot of my thinking. Because my grandfather, you know, made himself a very wealthy man in an environment of 70 plus percent effective tax rate and a massive punitive estate tax. And he managed to provide for not just two, but three generations after himself. So I have seen that the economy indeed can thrive in an environment of a high tax. And I have seen personally that, you know, I've been given tax cut after tax cut that I did not need and had not asked for. And then I've watched especially the Republican presidents who've given me those tax cuts go ahead and keep spending us into debt oblivion, the allegedly fiscally responsible party. So I just think that they've been trying to sell us this story of trickle-down economics and supply-side economics and the Laffer curve and the rest of it for, 40 years now. And it clearly doesn't work. It clearly is causing so much pain for so many people. And if the people who are benefiting by it don't speak up in favor of the people who aren't, I don't think there'll ever be any movement.
Well, I think, like you said, if people don't speak up, there will never be any movement. I want to, as we draw things to a close here, remind you of the epigraph that you used in Armor of Light. Yeah. Not to speak is to speak, not to act is to act. That's by Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And first of all, you are a tremendous counterexample in that you speak and you act, and you don't act in that narrow, what you might call, corridor of financial self-interest. There's no disguise here. And it's a very, very compelling example that you set. And it's a very, how would I say, inspiring in my mind, because we are at, you know, my name is Robert Johnson, like the old blues singer. One of his most famous songs is The Crossroads. And at the crossroads, you can either be overcome by fear and be frozen, or you can look towards your children. I have four children. I think you have a number of children as well. And you feel compelled to act on behalf of that future. And it's not just to build your own war chest inside your own fort. This is much more challenging than that. It's not just protection. It's the realm of the entire architecture of society that needs to be challenged. And when I thought about the example that you set and this need to act and the, how would I say, the model that you are of taking the road of action rather than being deterred by fear, I thought of the song by U2 called One. And that was in my mind. Often lyrics appear as I'm thinking about a person or an event, whatever, and they tell me what it is that I feel. And so in your honor, I would quote Bono and his band, "One love, one life, blood, one life. You got to do what you should. One life with each other, sisters and brothers. One life, but we're not the same. But we get to carry each other. We carry each other." Abigail, thank you for being our guest today.
My pleasure. It's been a pleasure.
And thank you for what you do in this life and sharing it with our audience.
Well, thank you. That's very kind of you. It's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
We'll talk again soon, perhaps after the election, and or next time you have a movie or a book or a poem.
And check out more from the Institute for New Economic Thinking at ineteconomics.org.
And I'll tell it and speak it and think it and breathe it, and reflect from the mountains so all souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking, but I'll know my song well before I start singing.